morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I can only say one thing this morning is called
brr. Is exactly right. Altogether too much.
Too much cold freeze.
But let's be grateful that we're not in Massachusetts. Yeah. And we're not in Chicago.
We're not in Brazil. We're on the mudslides.
And we're not in Atlanta either.
Yeah, and we're not in Brisbane with the flooding.
Yeah, we were in South Carolina for our granddaughter's birthday. And it was quite nice, but now they've got several inches of snow on the ground, so they're experiencing winter too. And I suspect the kids are probably enjoying it. Yeah, they're loving it because they don't have school and they get to play in the snow. What can be better than that? But as you know, listeners by now, if you've been listening to the program carefully, you'll know that we escaped over the Christmas holiday and avoided all the mess that affected the Northeast, because it didn't affect Pittsburgh too badly. In any case, we were in San Francisco, and in this program we're going to finish up our tour of the grand dining scene in San Francisco that we so much enjoyed. But we're going to start out there. Yeah, before we do that, we have exciting news for diners in Pittsburgh and visitors to Pittsburgh, soon to become a dining destination thanks to the work of aggressive, creative young chefs like our first guest in this program.
Yeah, now they're good restaurants, and they're good restaurants that are also exciting. And Notion, with Dave Rassicott, falls in the latter category.
We've been waiting anxiously for Dave to come back behind the stove with his toque on, except he doesn't wear one.
That's good.
We're delighted that he's gotten a new venture together. It's been open by now just about a couple of weeks.
And New Year's Eve.
And amazing how well things are going, considering the short time that the team has been together. They're really doing a fine job, and the greatest tribute to all, I think, we can say is that Dave Rescott hasn't missed a step.
No.
And we're delighted to bring him together to talk to you. He's a rather shy young man, but very intense, and I think you'll enjoy listening to him almost as much as you'll enjoy dining at Notion.
Dave Rassicott, this is your very first restaurant. You have to really step back a little bit, look at it, and give a great big happy smile to yourself, right?
Definitely. It's been a very long year for everyone that's been involved in this project.
Now, whatever caused you to call it Notion?
Honestly, coming up with a name was really the most difficult thing.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, I said that it was easier to name kids. But Notion was never even in one of the final names. I went to bed one night and said that it was going to be one of two names, and Notion wasn't one of those two names. I woke up the next morning, and that was really the first thing that came to mind. So,
well, what does it mean? I mean, because it doesn't have anything to do with food. It doesn't have anything to do with your address.
A notion is a belief in something. For me, it's a belief in a creative outlet. It's doing something on a whim. It's doing things your way. And you kind of have a notion to do something. And
you're certainly creative. We'll give you that one.
Oh, thank you.
You don't talk very loud, but you are creative. You don't even talk that much. But back up just a little bit. You are essentially self-taught, but you work with some really important mentors or chefs. And you did a lot of independent study, and I think in your case, as I've known you for so long, I can say that when you say self-taught, you have to assume that because it's you, it's very intense. You're intense at the education, the self-education that you've had.
Right. I believe that you get out of many things in life what you put into them, and I put a lot of study into this profession. I take this very seriously, and I think that I've really just been born with an ability to pair foods and an understanding of how foods taste and how they react together. But, you know, again, a lot of it is a lot of study. I was off yesterday, and I read for 14 hours. I mean, I sat on the couch.
14 hours?
Yeah, it's, you know, you start to get into things and into philosophies and thought processes and everything. The flavor Bible. I read some things online.
Yeah.
I read some things online. Watched some videos. But again, it's just an evolution. Food's moving so fast that you have to keep up with it.
Now, you have a fairly rigorous background. I mean, you ran the low track at Nemacolin and got five diamonds. What else?
Five stars from Forbes.
2 years in a row.
Yeah, it's difficult whenever you talk about yourself and try to still sound humble about it. We went to the James Beard House and did some dinners there.
I was going to say about the James Beard. When you walk into this restaurant, the first thing that hits you is the open kitchen.
Right.
And a lot of chefs would not like having everybody stop and say, talk to them and root in. But you said you love that, and you even love the James Beard Kitchen when everybody walked
in. I enjoy working at the James Beard Kitchen because it was a dream, and it was an event. And the people that come out for those events, that's really the expectation, is to meet the chef and to talk to the chef. And I think the same holds true with people that come to the restaurant. Personally, I would have never designed an open kitchen for myself, but I believe that it was here, and I think that it really kind of ties into what we're trying to do, at least today.
Well, this was a restaurant before you took it over. It was called the Boulevard Bistro, and you are in a place called Oakmont. Boulevard Bistro was pretty much a neighborhood hangout,
right?
And you're much more ambitious than that, although I'm sure you'd be happy to have a lot of repeat local business.
Right. Now, we've had so far... You know, we've only been open for a week, but we've had incredible community support so far. A lot of people from the community following on Facebook, a lot of people just stopping in, you know, to give well wishes. And so we've had great community support. Oakmont's a great community. There are a lot more people that live here, really, than people outside of the city understand. I really had no idea what Oakmont was before we started looking at this restaurant, but it's a great place, and I really, really, really like it here, and I'm really happy that we're here.
But you're not making meatloaf.
No, certainly not making meatloaf.
What are you making? Talk to me a little bit about the culinary concept of
Today we're focused on doing really good food, as high quality as possible. We're focused on purity of flavor. We're focused on the integrity of our craft and how we treat food products and what we do as chefs. All of our work habits that we have built over the last 10 years in this profession, they still are very much part of what we do on a day-to-day basis. But we also have an understanding that we are that we're in a neighborhood outside of the city, and that we need to make this restaurant an evolution.
You have a five-year plan, you said.
We do. We have a five-year plan.
You open to success, and you intend to just keep building on that for 5 years.
Right. And, you know, certainly food that we open with has the potential to change and evolve, but still it is still very good food. We're still using very modern techniques and still being very forward.
Progressive. What do you mean by that? You use all of the kitchen science that's known today, but not for its own sake.
Right.
There's logic to your cooking.
Right. There is nobody wants to come in and eat food that tastes like chemical, that tastes like agar-agar. We will employ modern cooking techniques, modern hydrocolloids that are just really modern to us, but that have been around for centuries in other countries.
But
really,
that's not an end in itself.
No, absolutely. We really, if you come in and you think about the food and you think about what goes into its preparation, you can enjoy what we have put into our craft as chefs. But at the same time, you can eat the same dish and just enjoy it for being a flavorful dish, and without thinking about what goes into it. You really don't notice that there are the modern technique that is there. So,
could you give us some examples of what we might be finding in front of us tonight?
Oh, I guess that depends on what you eat. I guess a very good example, I suppose, right now would be a broccoli dish that's on the menu. We take just plain, humble broccoli and manipulate it in four or five different forms. Garnish it simply. You know, for example, the broccoli stem. The broccoli stem is sous vide and cooked at 190 degrees for 4 hours. And I'm sure that everybody's had overcooked broccoli or overcooked cauliflower, and the taste of an overcooked cruciferous vegetable like that really transforms what it is, and it tastes kind of like cabbage, and it takes on a lot of sulfur compound, and you know it transforms the way that it tastes. Raw broccoli tastes completely at the opposite end of the spectrum as of a piece of broccoli that's been cooked for 4 hours. So we manipulate foods in that manner. So on this dish is burnt broccoli, shaved broccoli stems, stems that have been confit for 4 hours, raw broccoli tops, scalded milk foam, heavily roasted barley. So they're really, you know, there's three or four different flavors on the plate, but they're manipulated in such a way that there's a lot of different tastes.
Focus a lot on vegetables?
I focus on, I guess, kind of what's in season, which is, I guess, kind of redundant. Every chef does that, but I focus on really kind of just how I feel about cooking that day. I don't necessarily put a focus on thing. Really, I'd much rather cook proteins than vegetables, but you know, owning your own restaurant, if you put a protein on every dish, you're not going to stay in business very long. So You need to be smart about how you do things.
Well, you have a challenge, but at least the climate's getting better. Like last year, it's probably just as well you didn't open last year.
Right. No, no, this is a challenge for sure. But I've spoken with a couple of the chefs in the city. You know, I'm really, really, really excited about everybody's about the new restaurants that are opening. I'm really excited about Dinette and Spoon and Salt of the Earth, and I think that. You know, I think that Chris Bonfili is doing great things at Avenue B, and I really think that there are a lot of young chefs in the city, and we're really trying to make big steps and change food as being something that's important to everyone. It's a challenge for all of us, but I think that if we work hard and we stick to it, you know, we can finally make that change.
David, do you think that we're going to be able to make Pittsburgh into a destination dining scene?
I think that with the chefs that are here now, and really, I just hope to be an addition. I'm certainly not going to change anything on my own, that's for sure. Do I think that we can? I absolutely think that we can. I think that everybody needs to be realistic about how long it's going to take to do and the amount of time and hard work that we'll need to put into it. But I think that it can. I think more so than it being up to us as chefs, it's up to, you know, it's up to the consumer, it's up to the voter, it's up to the public to make it into a food town. The chefs certainly can't do it on their own.
You were big into goals when we met you at Nemecol, and you had set your mind on the five diamonds and five stars.
Yeah.
Do you have similar goals for Notions?
I have similar goals, certainly. And those are certainly part of what I hope this 5-year plan turns into. But again, the reality of, you know, of what we can do really depends on how the city accepts our evolution. And as we grow, if the city is willing to grow with us, most of my team is from Latrec. We've been together for 5 years at least, and we have the capacity really to be an incredible restaurant, but that's up to everybody else.
Why don't we close out with another of the dishes that just might be on tonight's menu?
On tonight's menu, a very simple dish, potato gnocchi with prosciutto consomme, lychee spheres, which is a liquid ravioli. You bite into the sphere, it explodes lychee juice in your mouth. It creates a gelatin on the outside with lychee liquid inside, Parmesan cheese, and arugula. Really, really simple.
Sounds great.
it tastes. I'm really, really happy with the way it tastes. And it's very simple. One little surprise in there. You know, something to try to start to open everybody's minds.
Listeners, this chef is an interesting fellow. Yesterday was his day off. So before we came on there, he said, but I spent 14 hours yesterday watching cooking shows and reading cookbooks. So you're not standing still, are you, David?
No, there's no time. Certainly no time to stand still in this industry. Everything will pass you by very, very quickly, and you'll be forgotten about before you know it.
Well, you're a terrific talent, and as I said, creativity is one of your strong points, but also very precise technique. I'm amazed at how you execute.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to this. It's a great addition to the city.
Thank you. I hope so.
So there's a website, David?
Yes, notionrestaurant.com.
And N-O-T-I-O-N, no S, yeah. listeners.com.
And the location is near the famous Oakmont Country Club, home of the U.S. Open and the U.S.
And
Women's
the
Open.
Oaks
and
Theater.
All that kind of stuff. Easy to find. Wonderful place. Free parking outside on the street?
Free parking outside.
How about that?
It's not a bad deal.
So we're looking forward to this evening, David. And Ann and Peter wish you every success. And on the menu, listeners, keep an eye on this Dave Racicot and Notions Restaurant in Pittsburgh.
Better still come. Well, of course, we had this interview before we actually ate. And I can now, after doing this, just whatever tasting items he wanted us to have, I can report that this broccoli dish was really spectacular. Both of us liked that the very best. And the gnocchi was also spectacular. That was with the prosciutto, the spurified lychee, or I guess it's lychee, isn't it?
I never have known how to pronounce it.
And ground padano cheese. And I love this beets dish with the fried, well, they call it crispy yogurt, but how did it get crispy? And a grapefruit with black currant. And I love my dish of lamb smoked in hay, which is the hot new ingredient now, hay, with roasted pine nut, red cabbage, and rosemary. Well, I mean, I liked it all so much, and the menu changes so often that I can't wait till we go back. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, and we're going to just shift a little bit to back to San Francisco, our long stay in San Francisco. And we just loved it there. And I was particularly fond of this next restaurant that we were talking to the owner and the chef about. It's called Marlo.
And the chef, Jennifer Puccio, just got an honorable mention somewhere as being a chef to watch. And having eaten there, we know why. So here are Jennifer and Anna.
Well, Ann and Peter had a wonderful lunch yesterday at Marlo, and now we're having a chance to interview the chef, Jennifer Puccio, and one of the owners, Anna Weinberg. I did that.
You did it. Well done.
Let's start with Anna. You are a New Zealander.
A Kiwi, yep.
You are a Kiwi, and you arrived in San Francisco via New York. Why?
That's all true. Well, I arrived in San Francisco via New York because my California-born husband convinced me it was a great idea, and I believe him now. But I was in New York because I am lucky enough to have an American passport. My father's American.
Uh-huh.
So at age 20, I decided that I wanted to live in New York and learn about food and wine and,
so
the restaurant business.
So you didn't know about all this when you arrived in New York?
Well, to the level that I could being in New Zealand. You know, we have a wonderful food culture in New Zealand. Fantastic wine, amazing products, but just not, definitely not the international variety. There's not the population. When I first landed in New York City, I worked at a restaurant for a couple of years called Il Buco, which is 100% of the food, wine, and olive oil of Umbria. It's not something I could have been exposed to in New Zealand.
Right. And you were at a restaurant called Stella.
After Il Buco, I went and worked for David Boulay for a little while and was lucky enough to meet a business partner, a female chef named Melissa O'Donnell, who the two of us opened a little tiny restaurant on McDougal Street called Stella, which was what we called a neighborhood food.
Okay, now here you are in San Francisco at a charming restaurant called Marlo. And what was your, I've read where you and a couple of friends just sort of got the idea to open a restaurant. I mean, I had done that
a
long time ago.
Well, Marlo's actually mine. Marlo's, I actually don't have any partners in Marlo, except now Jennifer. It was born out of, I mean, really what was going on in the climate in San Francisco. And
what, give us an idea of timing. When was this?
Well, we opened Marlo in February of this year, actually.
Okay.
And before Marlo, I had owned another restaurant called South Food and Wine Bar that was with a couple of partners from Australia.
Okay, that was the copy I read. That's
correct,
right. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
And,
so this year, you're bold and brazenly and on your own.
Well, actually, it was out of necessity. South really just wasn't working anymore. Find Jennifer, whose food has just really, really resonated, you know, kind of coupled with the feeling that we created at Marlo, which is really neighborhood, really intimate story. It's borrowed from my great-grandfather's butcher store. So I think it feels pretty authentic.
Isn't that a coincidence that there is that prominent butcher shop in Brooklyn called Marlo and Sons?
Right. Exactly. I think they might have. I mean, my grandfather's in South Boston was gritty, but somewhat legendary, I guess. So,
really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And, okay, so we have Jennifer.
Yes.
How did you get involved? How did you meet Anna?
Well, actually, it was online. I answered an ad, and...
But where are you from?
I'm from Boston.
You're a Bostonian.
I'm from the East Coast, yeah. And okay. I was most recently cooking in Boston before we came out to San Francisco.
Oh, okay. And where were you cooking in Boston?
I was cooking for a woman, Anna Sortoon, who now owns Oleana.
I love. That's one of my most favorite restaurants, and she's one of my most favorite chefs.
Isn't she amazing?
Oh.
She was totally, I would say, hands down my mentor. As far as the type of food that I love
no
to
No wonder
cook
this is all so great.
Oh, that's so interesting that you know her. Small world. Yes. Yeah.
So, how would you describe your style? I mean, how does it fit with this concept? I mean, it is accessible because we loved it, yeah. What do you aim for in terms of your cooking?
Well, I think the thing that's most important to me is to have a balance of flavors and to have the flavors be really big and bold, but still, you know, not over the top. So it's really easy to do American bistro food with
those sorts
of... So that's
what it's called, American bistro food.
Yeah, right. I think that's what I'd classify it as.
Okay, and you're open for lunch and dinner.
We are.
Yes, and what do you know the... Oh, here it is, right in front of me, the... Did you know what we had?
I have not heard yet, no, unfortunately.
Okay, well, we had the baked oysters. We had the classic steak tartare. The spiced prawns with the hot and boozy, and that's in quotation marks, cocktail sauce. Then we moved on. I had the poulet vert, which came with broccoli, toasted garlic, chili flakes, and of course we had the Brussels sprouts chips.
Okay.
Explain those. Who wants to explain those?
It was really simple, actually. I started doing them as staff meal at a restaurant because when you're trimming the Brussels sprouts, you have to take off the bottom and the leaves fall off. You can't use the outside leaves when you're roasting. So I had an excess of them and started frying them for staff.
Oh, and funny.
Everyone loved them so much that we decided to try them at the restaurant, and obviously they've been a big hit.
But labor-intensive, I mean, to do it in that quantity, right?
Yes. Our prep cooks are amazing, though. They can shuck a whole case of Brussels sprouts in 2 hours now.
It would kill us if they ever came off the menu.
Okay, and we had the steak. And... What did Peter have for dessert? Do you remember?
Yes, you had the bourbon pear crisp and the and also the chocolate cream pie made with Cho, which is a local chocolate maker.
Actually, they would have been great desserts, but the one I had was the carrot cake trifle, which was absolutely out of this world.
Oh, is that correct?
I ate the whole thing.
Oh, good. I'm glad that's brand new on the menu, so I'm glad you liked it.
It was so delicious. It's curious. My sister in England makes a vegetarian Christmas pudding. Now, Anna, you would all know about Christmas pudding.
I do.
And one of the unusual ingredients is carrots, and another ingredient is potatoes, and of course lots and lots of dried fruit. So it was almost like a seasonal Christmas pudding with cream. It was really excellent. Now the dinner menu is a little more expanded. You have more main dishes on the dinner menu. So why don't you mention a couple of those, Jennifer?
It's all because we're using beautiful seasonal Dungeness crab right now.
Oh yeah, that's a great idea. It's one of our newer dishes. It's blue sole, which also known as flounder, that we wrap around Dungeness crab that's been reduced with cream and fennel fronds.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really lovely, actually. And then we bake that and serve it with a shaved baby fennel salad with licorice herbs and a...
What are licorice herbs?
Well, you've got amaranth and beet greens, herbs that baby fennel fronds that taste like licorice.
Yeah. Yeah, licorice has become a very favorite. Well, it's been revived, but not as a candy, but as a flavor.
Yeah, exactly. I'm really fond of it.
Yeah, I like the roots you get, or the real licorice root from Calabria.
Oh.
I had that once on a saffron risotto shaved on. Who comes to your restaurants?
Well, I feel really lucky. We have an extremely nice clientele. A lot of that is made up of our neighbors. We live in the area that we're in is an area called Soma, which is a little bit like, people compare it to Tribeca in New York a little bit. It's industrial, and then it was really given a whole new life by AT&T Park. Of lofts, young professionals, and definitely people that enjoy eating out, have kind of maybe creative lifestyles in terms of what they do for a living. So we get our neighbors a lot of the time. And then during the day for lunch, we're sort of, In terms of San Francisco rather than actual Silicon Valley, we are 2.0 tech startup ground zero. You find more tech startups, more baby Facebooks and Twitters within like a 5-mile radius of our restaurant than just about anywhere else. So a lot of guys, a lot of engineers at lunch. You know, sometimes I'll look around and I'll think, I think there's two women in my restaurant.
I was watching them into the Brussels sprouts chips. I thought that was funny looking. These guys just sit around munching on Brussels sprouts.
That's the first course before the french fries that go with the burger.
Speaking of the burgers, something that really, you know, was wonderful for our business.
I didn't get to taste that because it looked
you have to make a special trip for it. I mean, Michael Bauer, the San Francisco Chronicle food critic, called our burger the best in San Francisco. Our burger, I take credit. Jennifer's burger. best in the Bay Area. So I read that.
Yeah, definitely.
That really is something that helps your lunch business for sure, if people know that they can come to you for an absolutely delicious burger.
Right.
But the killer sandwich, and we saw that around us, some people eating it delicately with a knife and fork, but other people grasping it firmly over the plate and allowing the juice to dribble, is the warm Caribbean shrimp roll with Napa cabbage slaw, basil, mint, citrus, aioli, smoke, and basil. And if you can eat it without wearing it, you're a real pro.
I can't.
No, we watched. How about giving us a website?
Oh, okay. So you can find us at www.marlosf, like San Francisco, .com. We also are on Twitter at MarloSF. And then Chef Puccio. Jennifer's on Twitter as well.
I am, too. I'm going to have to start following Jennifer. Yeah, and Michael Bauer is.
Certainly.
Anyhow, is anything else anybody should know about your restaurant? Just go. I'm telling you, the flavors are, as you say, they're strong, clean. I love it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to have you.
And now a quick commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Thanks for staying with us, because I think you're going to really enjoy this next interview we have. Our guest is not only a restaurateur, but he is, in general, an entrepreneurial personality, and he has some good things going for him. Let's listen to him. Well, I certainly have been overeating of late, but this was so delicious, and I can't thank you enough, Bruce Hill, chef, partner in a number of restaurants, which we will talk about. But as I said, we're now at 00, which is, tell us the cuisine.
Well, 00 really is based on...
No, I mean, you named your cuisine Calapolitan.
Oh, we named our cuisine Calapolitan, yeah.
Yeah, which is going to go on Wikipedia, you said.
Yes, we're working on getting that as a Wikipedia entry. But yeah, we really wanted to bring our local influences into the name, because this is California and we have wonderful, wonderful fruits and vegetables here.
Sure. And okay, we were here for lunch, and so I think it's probably it's a slightly different menu between lunch and dinner. And
yeah.
I've looked at the dinner menu too. But basically the consistent point that runs through the whole thing is really great ingredients and the Italian approach to presenting food. Is that correct?
Absolutely. What we really want to do is show true flavors, and that the way you do that is by not mucking up the stuff too much, you know.
Right.
Really limit your ingredients and keep the focus on the flavors.
Now, I mean, this was just a simple lunch. We had fabulous crudo. We had a bruschetta. Your bruschettas are wonderful. It's a thicker bread than I'm used to, and it just is. It was yummy. And we had, what did we have? We had avocado and lardo.
Right.
Ah, we're very adventurous.
and that's a special avocado, too, on that bruschetta.
What is it?
It's called a Gwen. It's a different variety I get from a local farmer.
It's called Gwen?
Gwen is the variety, yeah. They're
G-W-E-N.
A bit nuttier. Yeah, a little bit nuttier, more like a little bit of a hazelnut flavor to that avocado.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's it. But I probably can't get that east, huh?
No, you'd only get that on the West Coast.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, well. Anyhow, then we had sampled your homemade, house-made sausage.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also great. Do you make other kinds of meats? You cure other things?
We do, actually. We cure pancetta here, and we cure a little bit of lardo. At my other restaurant, Pico, in Marin County, we have a curing room. We make some copas and some other salumi.
You know, you had a dish on the dinner menu, I understand, which... Was it on the dinner menu with all the meats?
Oh, that's the Himerica plate.
Yes.
Yeah, that's on the dinner menu. And that actually, none of those hams are produced here. But we wanted to feature American hams. We wanted to kind of do something a little bit different. So that's why we decided to do the Himerica plate. And we currently have one ham from Iowa, one from Virginia, and one from Kentucky.
So you have La Quercia, no doubt.
Yeah, of course.
Iowa, right?
Of course.
Great stuff.
We were one of the first La Quercia accounts, too. And we really love their stuff.
Oh, it's good stuff.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, he's been on the program. program. I mean, if you can distinguish it from prosciutto to Parma, it's only because it probably tastes even better.
It's quite remarkable, and it's truly remarkable the way they've innovated that process too, with removing the bone as during. It's pretty spectacular.
That's an amazing thing to do.
Yeah.
And of course, the pride of place on your menu goes to pizza.
Right.
Although I'm telling you, I was tempted with the pastas. And tell us about those sandwiches.
Well, the pandemozzo is something we discovered doing research, and it seems to be a regional specialty.
I never even heard of it.
Yeah, of the Naples area. And really, it's just a small pizza dough that's not stretched out, par-baked, stuffed, and then it's re-cooked again on the flat grill. So it's a press sandwich.
Aha.
Yeah.
And then...
Now, does it have a little bit of extra dough so that you can grab onto it?
Yeah, the dough's not stretched out as thin. So it's a 9-ounce dough.
Because in my native land, there's a famous dish called a Cornish pasty.
Mm-hmm.
And we read that Cornish pasties were constructed for people who worked in tin and copper mines, who had very dirty hands.
Mm.
So they needed a place to hold on to what they were eating.
Right.
That they eventually would throw away. And I wondered if maybe the construction of this Naples sandwich was the same way.
Mm. I think it really probably came from just the fact that they had pizza dough laying around all the time. They just came up with another use for it.
And so then we have salads we mentioned. One of the highlights in this particular restaurant, everybody's raving about, and we have to admit we did not try, is your make-your-own sundae with... Tell us about this soft-serve ice cream.
Yeah, well, the soft-serve ice cream really is a childhood memory of mine.
Soft-serve.
Yeah,
soft-serve.
And it's something... I grew up on the East Coast with Mr. Softy and Carvel and things
we
like
all
that.
Did, yeah.
And so I have these wonderful memories of the soft-serve ice cream. But when I looked into reconstructing it or serving it in my restaurants, I realized how artificial and how many additives were in soft-serve mix.
Oh, it's chemicals, right.
Yeah. In fact, a lot of the soft-serve mix isn't even a liquid. It's a powder that you add water to.
Oh, yeah.
Reconstitute, and then you put it in the machine. So we went on this journey of trying to create a soft-serve ice cream that was completely organic using local ingredients. We started to work with Strauss Dairy, which is in Marin County, and really just trial and error over the years of working it out, coming up with a really good mix that was consistent. And we figured it out. It took about a year and a half, and we figured it out. And so that's what we serve now. But the fun thing is that you get to pick your toppings and your accompaniments with your ice cream. You can really have anything you want. So we give you a little menu that's multiple choice, and you just check the things that you want, and off you go.
And a little pencil, number two pencil.
Yeah, a little pencil, of course. Yeah. Our signature flavor still is vanilla with some local olive oil and a little bit of sea salt. And that's another flavor combination that we kind of became famous for. We started serving that in 2005, and you actually find vanilla ice cream with olive oil and sea salt all over the country now.
Well, you've had a very interesting journey to get where you are. You've come through institutional cooking, you've come through fine dining, you've come through really adventurous mentors in the California cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
You cooked with Mario Batali.
Yep.
Yeah, you've done all that. So what made you settle on pizza?
Well, you know, it's funny. We did this little restaurant, Pico, 2005, and the restaurant was subdivided. It was like two-thirds restaurant, and then the previous owner had a small takeout area. We figured that we could put an oven in there, and my business partners just kind of, they challenged me. They said, hey, why don't you make really amazing pizza? You can make everything else. You know, so they just thought I could do anything. And so we went on the journey, and I found out about some of the certification programs and became very interested in true Neapolitan pizza.
So you're really certified as a pizzaiolo?
Yes, I am certified. Yeah.
That's great.
And I really wanted to be true to the roots of real pizza. So unfortunately, in America, there's a lot of different opinions about pizza. I'm sure you've heard them all.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. But you're Italian, so you also know what real pizza is. And I just wanted to be true to the roots of the product. So that's really my quest there.
Ingredients are really fresh and wonderful.
Yeah, oh yeah. And we want to really use some discipline there too. You know, we're not going to make some silly combination, something sweet or something odd. I really try to use a lot of discipline on the pizzas as well.
Yeah, Anne was totally horrified because in England, two of the ingredients they put on pizza are pineapple, canned pineapple, and sweet corn.
Yeah.
Clearly neither of which belong, but...
They all say that it's American pizza, which is not true, I don't think.
Yeah. Not even Americans would do that.
Well, you once in a while see the people...
If you did that.
Yeah, they think that the Hawaiian pizza is authentic with the pineapple and the ham, but the corn never. You never see corn on pizza. In fact, corn you see in Asian cultures, canned corn on food like
really?
That. Yeah. Well, and interestingly, in Asian culture, canned corn is often used as a dessert as well.
See, along your trail of experience, you also ran a Asian-Italian fusion restaurant, did you?
I did, yeah. And I've spent quite a bit of time in Asia, in Japan and in Hong Kong, doing a couple of guest chef visits over there. So, yeah, I definitely spent some time. But, yeah, in the 90s, I did fusion food. I definitely did Asian-inspired cooking and just ventured away from it because I just wanted to really work with local ingredients and really wanted ingredients to be the focus of my food.
That was the period I went through when I was a formal restaurant critic. And I thought if I got another shot of raspberry vinaigrette, I was going to die.
Yeah, it got a bit silly for a while.
Now, tell us, you've alluded to various other restaurants. Give us your family of restaurants right now.
Okay. Well, I'm a partner at Bix Restaurant, and I've been a partner there since 2002. Bix is a modern supper club that's located in the historic Jackson Square district of San Francisco. And Bix really is a retro restaurant that uses very modern sensibilities. So although it looks very old school on the outside, the menu is mostly local products and very organic and very much focused on local farmers.
There's also a jazz music component.
Right. There's live jazz every night at Bix. So we're considered San Francisco's premier supper club.
Okay.
And then in 2005, I opened up Pico, which is in Marin County. And Pico is actually two restaurants in one building. There's a small plate restaurant, and then there's also a wood-fired pizzeria in the same building. It's just two different entrances. And that was really where I started my love of wood-fired pizza. And also the soft-serve ice cream was invented up at Pico. So we ran that for 5 years. And then in 2009, the opportunity for the space, which is now 00, came along. And my chef at Pico, Chris Whaley, who's here with us now, told me that he wanted to move down to the city and take over. So we had a beautiful opportunity with the right amount of management and a good space to move down and open up a new place. So with Chris's hard work behind me and some other great people here, we were able to open up 00 in August of 2010.
And this is a super convenient location because it's at Folsom and 4th Street.
Right.
So it's three blocks south of Market Street. In this train, everybody says the trendy SoMa district.
Yep.
The nice part about it, it's a cater corner from the Yerba Buena Gardens, which is a beautiful space. So it's real convenient. The warning we would give you is if you're sure you want to come here, make a reservation because today you're filled with walk-ins. What a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Looked like it might be a slow day today for lunch and filled up.
Oh, this is busy.
We definitely recommend reservations and we're on Open Table. So you can just go to Open Table and check out, or you can give us a call.
Now, am I recalling correctly that at Pico, you do a special menu sometime during the week?
Actually, we do, on Mondays. Pico has a menu called Marin Monday, and what we do is we give you, it's usually a 5 or 6 course menu, and all the ingredients in that menu are sourced from Marin County. So it's a very nice local menu. We have quite a nice following for that.
You're really busy.
Yeah.
Are you working on a new concept?
No, but I actually have my cooking product. I have a cooking tool that I've invented that I'm going to be promoting really hard this coming year. My cooking product is called the Chef's Press, and it's a high-tech bacon press. And what it does is it allows you to press food while it's cooking, but not press it too much so you squeeze all the juice out. It just presses it enough.
Its own weight presses it.
Well, the weight is adjustable by adding additional presses. So you can stack them and add more weight. And this is currently being sold by Williams-Sonoma. And you can buy a pack of three for about $25.
And tell me again what you do with this. Just
We use them for grilled cheese sandwiches. We use them for fish. At Bix, we use them for our
hamburgers.
They're
very handsome.
Yeah.
It's also a great way to keep your bacon flat.
Yeah.
Well, bacon is the first thing I thought of.
It's really just taking an old idea of the traditional old, smash the bacon press and taking some new technology and adding a new idea to it by making it adjustable so that you can adjust the weight. But also the slots that are in the tool allow venting because when you press food, it does give off a lot of steam.
Well, I mean, certainly much more elegant than a foil-wrapped brick.
Yeah. Well, you'd be amazed by some of the chefs that are using it. It's probably being used by about 30 of the top chefs in San Francisco and a couple of top chefs in New York City right now.
Well, listeners, you want to get in on the action. You need to stay tuned. Are you on Facebook?
I am on Facebook, and all my restaurants are on Facebook as well.
Okay, and how are you, Bruce Hill?
You can look me up as Chef Bruce Hill.
Chef Bruce Hill.
Or you can look up 00 Pico or Bix Restaurants.
Great. Well, keep us posted.
I will.
I'm sure you'll be up to something new very soon.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yes, yes, for sure.
He's just bursting with energy, this guy. Thanks, Bruce.
All right, nice to meet you all.
And now another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, didn't we get around? Moving on.
We did.
We did all kinds of different things. The next place was really fun. I could eat there again, too.
Well, there are actually two. We're going to put them together because Michael Pierce of Maverick and Scott Euculus, co-owner of Maverick and also the owner of Hog and Rocks, are two close-by restaurants in the Mission District. We perfected how to get to the Mission District on the BART system. We thought we were very clever to do that. And these are places that are very convenient to that underground system, which gets you there much quicker and much less expensive than trying to do it by taxi. Maverick was their first venture, and then Hog and Rock's a second venture. We're going to run them together because they sort of belong together because,
after all, the same guys
own them. They're partners.
And we're going to start there with Hog and Rock's.
We're going to start with Hog and Rock's, and then we're going to go to Maverick for no particular reason other than alphabetical, maybe.
Scott Euculus. We had just a wonderful brunch, lunch, just about everything we possibly order off the menu at your restaurant, Hog and Rocks. I think you have a lot to say, and I guess we're going to just try to work around what you should tell our listeners.
Okay, sure.
Your background is very complicated in many ways, interesting and colorful, but short take on it, you were trained in business and also trained as a chef.
That is right, yeah. Well, I went to school at Indiana and then eventually Indiana University and then Johnson & Wales for culinary school.
And then you just worked in the restaurant business and then you just sort of serendipitously
I can't even say it. It's contagious.
Anyhow. With your partner and figured out you could make a go of a restaurant together. And you made a go of two restaurants together, actually. We did Maverick before, and now we're doing Hog and Rocks. What about the name? Start with the name.
With Hog and Rocks, well, we just wanted to do the whole concept behind Hog and Rocks was to do a kind of neighborhood bar and grill type thing, and something that we don't see very well executed in San Francisco. And so to start with that as something simple, cocktails and just good bar food, I wanted to bring on kind of another element that would make it kind of more exciting. And we thought the oysters, because there's no really great place in the Mission in a casual setting to eat oysters and have an oyster bar.
Well, so, now you have the Hog also.
It started with the oysters, and then I at the same time at Maverick, I had been using country hams from Kentucky and been putting them on a menu, and I've been really kind of getting into learning more about something that I had known about growing up in Cincinnati, about because we're so close to Kentucky and the traditions of country ham, but never really from a culinary standpoint, it had always been kind of really just stuck in the South, and it wasn't much more than just a cheap commodity. Nowadays you see it's become popular again and fine dining restaurants to places like here where it's sliced thinly and served prosciutto style or serrano ham as they would in Spain or in Italy. And so I felt that with the oysters being a thing that everyone likes and is great bar food, well, ham and salty meats is another great bar food. So, and if you don't eat oysters, well, you got to eat ham. And if you don't, and vice versa. So, and if you don't eat either, well, then you probably should go somewhere
else. But you don't really think of this as a bar.
No, we run the line, between a bar and a restaurant. We try to be much more of a bar in its philosophy. Well, it's a restaurant in the way it's run with service and stuff, but it's a bar in the sense of it's a fun place to come have drinks, bring your friend anytime. No reservations, that kind of thing. Very casual.
Oh, so you got to take reservations.
No, reservations for only 8 or more. So, yeah, it's pretty much a no-reservation place.
Now, there's another interesting piece of your antecedents that you mentioned that might put you in the bar business. You mentioned that your family used to be involved in illegal interstate commerce.
We can't say this on air, though, can we?
We can because we're not regulated by the FCC.
Okay.
And the statute of limitations has long expired.
It's probably long expired. Okay, fine then. Yes, they were, my great uncles were, got my whole entire family into the United States through rum running. And so there's a rich tradition in my family.
And you're continuing because I'm looking across at a board on the wall. And I don't know whether you see it every day, but it says $9 beer and shots.
Yes.
I mean, it's almost like we should be back home in the steel mill areas of Pittsburgh.
Exactly. Drinking Yinglings and, I don't know, what else. What do you drink in Pittsburgh? Yingling and, or is that a Philadelphia thing?
Mostly Iron City.
Oh, Iron City, yes.
And the original Boilermaker, as I understand it, you used to get a beer and then you got your whiskey in a glass and you dropped glass and
into the glass.
That's a real Boilermaker.
That's a real Boilermaker. But so, now we've fancified it, and now we have a beer and shot pairing where the two are supposed to work together.
I you a great fantasy. Keep going.
I just thought.
and finishing with tea.
And I'm having green tea.
Yeah.
And I had beer, which I'm still having.
Yes. Yeah, so, well, we have a little bit of something for everyone. French press coffee to green tea and beer and whiskey, lots of whiskey. We have like something around 50 different whiskeys, ranging American whiskeys, rye, bourbon, a Tennessee whiskey, to fine scotches and even Japanese whiskey as well.
Yeah,
so
you
very
have a
extensive.
Lot of regulars here. And
yeah.
I mean, I saw people coming in with their kids and you gave them crayons and
yeah.
Things to color.
Yeah.
Pigs. I saw lots of them.
The pig, that was an idea from one of our servers here. I thought it would be a cute idea to draw a pig and then have a little coloring book, more or less. And so the kids, yeah, you know, we're certainly not a family restaurant, but it's San Francisco is a very kid-friendly city, and we like to accommodate to everyone, really.
One of the most remarkable things is sort of a really eclectic, oops, that's after lunch, I can tell. A really eclectic collection of dishes that embrace heritages from all over the place. Let me start off with my heritage because you have a really excellent quality cotton chips.
Yep.
With chips that are wonderfully crisp.
Yep.
But you get, with a California touch, to dip them in aioli, spiced aioli, so it's more like a Belgian fry. But the cod with the beer batter is really extraordinary. It's one of the best I've eaten outside of my native land.
Oh, thank you.
It was good too.
It's good. Super crispy, light, buttery fish, flaky fish. Yeah, and the vinegar. I'm all vinegar. Yeah, Kennebec. Yeah, they.
I'm a sucker for fried.
And then the other, and then at dinner we do fish pie, which I'm sure you're familiar with as well.
I saw it on the menu.
our great niece makes fish pie, and Heather, I hope you're not listening, because it's really, the way you make it, it's not entirely to our taste. I bet Hog and Rocks is a whole lot better.
That's my first fish pie experience was at Wright Brothers Oyster House in London, and we had been out late that night prior and downing pints and pints of beer. And so having oysters wasn't enough to soak up the pints of beer, so we had fish pie. And it happened to be one of the most wonderful things we'd had the whole entire trip.
Now, the revelation on the menu is a dish called Goetta. No, it's called Goetta Fiorentina, except it comes from?
Cincinnati. It's my hometown. It's an old German thing. And it's something that we sell the most of. I think it's because it causes somewhat of a interesting story, but it's a very some people would I guess it falls in the same category as Scrapple. A lot of people know Scrapple.
Yeah,
it's in that same kind of idea, but it's basically a braised pork shoulder that's been kind of picked apart, and then we take oats and cook the oats, and that becomes a binding agent for the pork. We mix it all together into almost a big sausage, and then they're cut into patties and they're fried in a pan. We do it with spinach and poached eggs and hollandaise.
And then you have a BLT where the L stands for lamb.
That's right.
Although there is.
Or no, the B stands for belly.
Oh, the B stands for belly.
Belly,
oh, okay,
lettuce, tomato.
Right.
Yeah.
That was
that's a great, great sandwich. Yeah.
And the sandwiches are wonderful as well. And we also sampled the corned beef tongue hash. I mention that only to indicate that you have some really unusual dishes on offer. And darn, we did not try the skillet beef patty melt, which sounds really wonderful.
That's kind of a throwback to the Midwest and the diners of that you see all across the country where you take beef patty and then we kind of up the ante and put on a whole assortment of mushrooms and real Swiss cheese, Emmentaler, and rye bread, locally baked rye bread, and Frisco sauce. So, yeah, that's a huge, very popular dish here.
We just visited the breakfast, brunch, and lunch menu, but there's also a dinner menu, which is a little more extensive.
Okay, yeah. What is your star on the dinner menu?
Well, the most popular and one of our house favorites would be the cast iron octopus. It's large.
Oh, I wanted to try that.
Yeah, it's a large octopus. It's been braised, braised, and then it's cut into pieces, and then it's cast iron, so it gets nice color on it with potatoes and jalapenos and ham.
Why did you pick that? It seems like an unusual dish for this.
Well, potatoes, and you see a lot octopus and potatoes kind of comes together, and then we had this idea where we have all these extra ham bits because we get these whole country hams, and there's ends. You have the hock and you have other ends. When we're slicing it all, there's always scrap. So we take the scrap and we have to make the best of it. And so we grind it and we use it in all various kinds of things. We do it with the Brussels sprouts. We make vinaigrettes. We do throw it into dips and all kinds. Anything we can use, we do it because it tends to be quite a bit of meat and that's left over. So
now who actually cooks here?
My chef, Ray, is the chef de cuisine. Ray England is his name. He runs a kitchen, and this guy's worked with me for a while. He spent a little time at Maverick. Originally, he's been in San Francisco now for a year. He's spent 3 years prior to San Francisco in Los Angeles working at Kraft and Kraft LA under Tom Colicchio. And his chef then was Matt Accarino. Matt is now here in San Francisco as well. But Ray's really young, talented guy. He runs the kitchen. I've kind of put myself more into kind of operational guy, director of operations, owner, manager, host, phone answer, plunge the toilet. Anything needs to be done, I do. Run the errands, make the deposits, do the books.
Having owned a restaurant, I understand the whole bathroom.
I do it all.
Now, there's one last thing we have to visit here, which is famous.
Oh, the hot sauce.
Uke's hot sauce. Go ahead.
Uke's hot sauce is something was born out of an early afternoon at Maverick about almost 5.5 years ago, and we had some chilies that we had a whole case. We were supposed to buy 3 pounds, we bought a pound and we bought a case instead, and so we didn't know what to do with them. So I roasted them and I picked the stems and I blended it with some vinegar and seasoned it really well and thinned it out just right. And I said, oh my God, we made hot sauce. And so we started serving it at brunch, and then someone had a terrible idea to tell me to start selling it. I thought that was the worst idea, but best idea ever. Best idea because they told me to do a worst idea once I actually had to start bottling it and selling it and going through that whole process. And now I'm up to, I use a local catering company, their kitchen. I process about 800 pounds of chilies, and over one day, I make all the sauce, a couple hundred gallons of sauce
in one day,
and then it's bottled over a course of the next couple days. So it's all hand-picked chilies, then hand-roasted and de-stemmed. They're then hand-blended, and then we mix them and bottle them by hand, label them by hand. It's a true artisan product.
How does somebody get this?
And you can go to ukeshotsauce.com to buy it online, YOUKSHOTSAUCE, ukeshotsauce.com. I sell it online for $7 a bottle. Shipping.
And a bottle will last you for a very long time.
It's got good heat to it. And the other part of it that's always been for the last 3 years, 4 years, I've done, I do kind of a slightly different variation depending on the chilies that are available to me from Mariquita Farm, who I purchased all the chilies from. And Andy, who's the Andy Griffith, who's Griffin, he's the farmer and owner. He's a real chili head, so we've really gone together and kind of created a product that really shows off, you know, his passion. And again, goes back to helping the small farms, just as we do with the country hams, helping small farmers do their thing and so we can do our thing and become a good. It's great, more of a marketing tool than anything. But I sell it around town and we use it at the restaurant. So,
well, this is a fabulous place to come. You're open
every night.
Every night.
Weekends we do brunch at both Maverick and Hog and Rocks. Yeah.
And the Hog and Rocks website is
hogandrocks.com, HOGANDROCKS.com. Yeah, and you can, no reservations, but you can call us up or walk in anytime.
And are you planning something else? Because you seem to be hot.
I'm always on the move. Yeah, I'm what they call a deal junkie. No, I'm always thinking about the next step. And
what might that be?
Well, we're considering keeping it in the casual realm, maybe something to do with smoked meats, barbecue, something along those lines.
Well, you'll be sure to let us
know. Whiskey and tequilas and lots of beer.
And you'll be sure to let us know so we can put it on our website and let everybody know about it.
For sure, and hopefully in the next, sometime in the next year or so. It's already in the works. Not to give it away or anything.
No. Let's not give too much away.
Yeah.
But I can assure you that there are very few things I crave because I get to eat almost anything I want. And I think that lamb belly BLT is probably going to be way up on my list.
Great. Good to hear. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming in. I appreciate your time.
We're at Maverick in the Mission District, and we're talking to Michael Pierce, owner, and also GM and wine director. He has many hats. And also chef de cuisine, Matt Brimmer. Or is it Brimer?
It's Brimer.
Brimer.
It's okay, I get it all the time.
And we're missing somebody, Scott Euclid.
Scott Euclid, yeah.
Who's your partner, who's busy at his other restaurant, which we're going to go to on another day, called
Hog and Rocks.
Hog and Rocks. Let's start with Michael. Michael, you are a transplant to this area, are you not?
I am, yes.
But you studied all kinds of other interesting things, including
emerging markets
and whatever. But basically, you spent a long time in restaurants.
Yes, I living in New Jersey, where labor laws aren't really stringently practiced, I was able to get a job bussing tables at a restaurant, I think at a young age of 13 or 14, and that was my start in the restaurant industry, and I've pretty much consistently been working in restaurants ever since.
But it was a risky business to jump into opening a restaurant, you and Scott, right?
Yeah.
But you said your wives encouraged this?
Well, you know, Scott,
I never heard that story before.
Scott has always had a vision of opening a restaurant, went to culinary school, has an uncle that owns a couple restaurants in Tribeca, who was kind of his mentor. I always did it, enjoyed the lifestyle I could lead and travel
and you still love it, you said.
Oh, I still love it. Always loved it, but always didn't think I'd knew enough about it that knew I maybe didn't want to open one. But it got to a point with my wife, who comes from a family of doctors and lawyers, where there was kind of a, so what are you going to do moment? And that led to more conversations, and my wife and Scott's wife, you know, Scott was looking for someone to open a restaurant with, and we were best friends, and it worked together for 4 years, and we're really on the same page, so it seemed like a good fit.
Okay, and you are a native California,
Matt.
You are from the south of the border, however.
Yes, the burbs of Los Angeles.
Right, and you've been in restaurants a long time as well, huh?
That's correct.
But this is sort of a risky venture, too, to come to a restaurant almost on the spur of the moment in many ways.
Definitely, huh? Yeah.
So we're all having an adventure, and you're all having a good time. Tell us about this restaurant. First of all, why is it called Maverick?
So we wanted one word, something that evoked Americana, something that was strong and masculine, easy to say, easy to pronounce, easy to remember. And some of the other ones were Bounty and Caliber and Range. And when we did our research, we really kept coming back to Maverick. The etymology of the word is American in its origins. It relates to Samuel Maverick, who was a cattle rancher in the 1800s.
Oh, I never knew that.
In Texas,
interesting.
He would not brand his cows, his herd. So everybody else was always branding their herd, and he refused to do it. And therefore, any stray cattle was called a Maverick.
Now, we always thought it was James Garner.
Well, as you go to the bathroom, you'll see we have some old Maverick posters on the wall, but But no, Samuel Maverick, his family still lives in Texas. And yeah, he was an innovator, someone that went against the grain and was an individualist and did things his own way.
How does this restaurant relate to that then, to that concept?
Well, we always are, as I mentioned earlier, we always are trying to kind of push the envelope within this American cuisine, this regional American cuisine moniker and cuisine style. We're always trying to do things a little different, put a twist on things, and show people's techniques and food and combinations that maybe they haven't seen before.
But you say you draw from all over the world, people to come here. What's the big food draw, Matt?
That's easy.
Well,
unfortunately, it's not Matt's dish, but he's married to it, whatever.
Yeah, well, we're
however he wants.
Our southern fried chicken. You know, yeah.
Oh, that's a hot item now, isn't it?
This place is built on fried chicken. Yeah, we sell so much. It's, yeah, definitely the top seller. Yeah.
Is yours as good as Thomas Keller's? That's his big thing.
I've never had Thomas Keller's, but I think we're definitely up there, if not better.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's the only one thing that will not. Has never come off the menu, and it's been on the menu for about 4.5 years now. And
what style is it?
Traditional southern fried chicken.
Southern fried. It's buttermilk, so brine, buttermilk.
Yeah. Fried low temperature.
Yeah.
You're in California, but here you have Baltimore crab fluffs, southern fried chicken, Belgian endive.
I mean, that was a throwback to the original idea with this restaurant, with our menu, which our original menus, we changed them tons, but was to hit on those regional things. Like Baltimore crab fluff. Scott and I were going through old Americana cookbooks and kind of drew on a lot of recipes that were very regional. Anybody who's grown up in Baltimore, who's lived there, will come in and say, oh, I had these when I was a kid. And that was the whole idea right there with our menu, to have stuff. People say, oh, spoon bread. You know, my grandma used to make this. Whereas if you grew up in San Francisco, you never heard of spoon bread. So, and as I said, that was where we started, and as the menu has evolved and as the product has evolved and technique has evolved, it's become a little more general when it comes to the California and American cuisine. But we still have to harken back to those very regional specific dishes.
But you seem still to be open, flexible, and evolving. Any directions that you're going to add, Matt?
Well, for the most part, you know, the food is very traditional. It's very it was comforty, I think, a little more before I start here. I'm trying to do a little more refined food. Still the same Maverick flavors. I've done the foie gras, for instance, on the menu. It's a very modern technique. So the foie gras, it comes in, it's cured, and then it's cooked and then pressed. I call it the Elvis foie gras. So it's just banana, peanut, and bacon. We have a nice little twist. I do a bacon marmalade,
right,
and then like a caramelized banana puree, and then some dehydrated bacon and a peanut dust. Some little warm brioche on the side. So I call it the Elvis foie gras.
You have, in addition to it's a fairly edited, a small menu overall.
Definitely.
You have first plates, including crispy rabbit rillettes.
Yes.
Which, that's sort of unusual for an Americana menu, isn't it?
Definitely. Well, you know, a lot of the food, we do a lot of French technique. We don't really try and work. If we're going to do anything here, we do a lot more French stuff. We don't do much Asian. But the rillette, it's kind of hard to call a rillette something else other than a rillette, because it's cured meat that's confit in fat and then re-emulsified back together. You really can't call it anything else.
We kind of thought, I mean, it would be kind of a exercise in semantics to take any kind of, to call it like really American cuisine, because America is such a melting pot, and
definitely,
and so many of the techniques that they, even from the South that you're on, the Southern cuisine come from other cultures, because
Absolutely.
We are such a young country. So we've always been very aware of that, and we haven't been afraid to like do duck confit and some of those classic things. But the key is always, you know, using local produce and still having those flavors that resemble American flavors.
You said that everybody, from even global tourists, come here. How does everybody know about this place?
Well, again, we've been around five and a half years. We've been successful. We definitely got a lot of good press in our first 3 years. That just leads to kind of a viral thing where the hotels know you. We strive as hard as we can for anybody. The best marketing is sending people out with having a great experience.
Oh, yeah.
And we work really hard at that. I mean, Scott and I are, you know, he's not here so much anymore, but I'm here all the time making sure everything is precise and everybody leaves happy. And that's it right there. I mean, you get enough people through this small restaurant over the years that leave happy. They tell enough people who tells enough people. So a lot of times when people come in from like Florida or Colorado or Texas, they'll come to San Francisco, you know, once a year, and I hear this all the time. They say, you know, we always come back here. So it's getting them in once, and they tell their
it's
friends.
It's a very sweet a comfortable environment. You have this communal table over here.
Yep, it's communal. It's also used as a large table as well. We can sit up to 10 guests there and even 12 sometimes.
Right, so and the kitchen, you can watch the goings-on in the kitchen.
Keeps them on their toes, yes.
Yeah, I don't know that. And then how many seats?
Generally, anywhere from 35 to 40 seats.
That many, that's good.
That's our maximum, yeah.
You know what? I think Peter's probably going to have the beef short rib with the celery root, spinach, and gremolata. I've never had gremolata on beef short rib.
And I'll bet that Anne's looking at the Loch Duart salmon with the Manila clams, andouille sausage, butter beans, and hedgehog mushroom. I got a little bit of a guess in that direction. What she's gonna do in the first course, I have no idea, but I know she loves baby beets. And there's some pomegranate and French feta going along with that. So there's something here for everybody, and it looks like we're going to have a wonderful time.
And if that's not enough, one of the side plates is mac and cheese made with Parmesan and white cheddar. And I also had my eye on the Swiss chard, as I like it, with golden raisins, pine nuts, and harissa. I never had harissa with it.
Oh, it's delicious.
Oh, well, Matt, I can hardly wait to try it all. And wine forest mushrooms, thyme shallot, and ricotta salata, which happens to be not well enough known as a cheese and one of my favorites. Well, this looks like a great place to settle in. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Let's take a break, and please stay with us, and we'll join you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're glad you're still with us in this marathon program, but we did want to finish up California in a timely fashion, and to complete our journey, we actually crossed the bay, part of it anyway.
It was like going back in time, to Berkeley.
It was, to the little university town of Berkeley and a restaurant where we interviewed the owners because they had a fascinating cookbook they produced, and we said, well, when we're out next in San Francisco, we must come and see you. They said, absolutely, you must. So Christopher and Veronica at Eve Restaurant in Berkeley, California.
Now, On the Menu has talked to Veronica and Christopher Laramie before, you'll recall, but we've not, it took us a little bit of time to get here. We finally arrived in Berkeley at the restaurant Eve, and it's good to see you in person, both of you.
Yeah, it's good to finally put a face to the voice.
Yes.
Let's
thank
give
you for
a brief recount of how did this restaurant get started? And you built it by hand, right?
Correct. The restaurant kind of got started on a whim. It was a long weekend out here for us that we took a little break. Base was open. The chocolate shop next door was a friend of ours. We put a couple things through the city to see if we could get a change of use. And then 6 months later, we were open.
Okay. Now, you are a chef.
Yes.
And Veronica, you are a pastry chef.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And where are you from?
I'm Peruvian.
You're Peruvian.
Yes.
A place well-known for food.
Of course.
Yeah. And what were some of the difficulties you had in organizing the place, which is totally charming, I must say. It looks like a professional design job rather than doing
it. Well, thank you for that.
We've been thinking about it for a long time. It's been the restaurant in our minds for probably the last 6 years. So some of the challenges were normal things, permitting, city stuff.
Staying within the budget.
Staying within the budget. Yeah, yes. Sure, all that stuff.
And the space itself, because, you know, it's California, so everything is more expensive. We had to compromise a little with the space, so we had to become very creative for storage and things like that.
We're sitting on it, actually.
Yeah, and there's our banquettes. It's all our dry goods storage and our wine cellar.
You have an open kitchen, and how many seats do you have?
We have 28 seats.
Aha. Uh-huh. So it's a good place for you to really show your technique and creativity, right?
Sure. It's large enough that we can pretty much keep an eye on everything and it doesn't get too out of control.
Now, who comes here?
Well, of course, neighbors, you know, people that just live around here, because in Berkeley people love to walk and bike everywhere. So the closer it is to their home, the most likely that they will come. And then a lot of grad students from the university, because we are very close to it. And then I think we've been doing pretty good, that our word is been getting a little more out, and we're getting people from other towns, you know, San Francisco, because we have like the BART, which is a train station.
Well, which is how,
like,
we got here. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like two blocks from here.
Yeah, it really is a 30-minute ride and walk from downtown San Francisco. It's unbelievably rapid. And it made me feel so good. I felt so responsible and sustainable.
Sure.
Taking public transportation and a Shanks pony to get here. It's not something that you think about doing a lot, but you think about doing it a lot when the alternative of driving takes so much longer.
Right.
And it's so expensive to go over the bridge and everything. There's always traffic. So people like it. We're really close to one of the biggest theaters in Northern California, which is Berkeley Repertory.
Oh, really?
And so it's like between the BART station and our restaurant. It's right there in the middle.
Yes. We have Peter's whispering something about tonight's menu. He's hungry, maybe. I don't think you could be. Exactly. We're kind of hitting the pre-hour, pre-service is what we're doing.
I think we're okay on time for a little
bit.
Yeah,
we're good.
So tell us a little about the menu then. Who's going to do that? Chris?
Sure. The menu right now is basically what we're finding in season and local. And you know, for us, it's so easy because most of the products are local. Everything that's in season is cheaper because there's an abundance of it. It tastes better because it's the right time of year. And so it makes putting together a menu pretty easy.
What is this farm egg?
The farm egg right now? Oh, it's a take of a Southern Korean
breakfast.
So in the south of the United States, there's a big Korean population, mostly like Georgia, that area. So we are combining like kimchi flavors with grits. Of course, egg is like the perfect combination for all of those flavors. So that's where the inspiration came from.
Right. And you've got albacore tuna. I guess that's a tricky one. Hmm?
That's local. Yeah, it's actually
with sunchoke, black radishes, kumquats, capers, and olive oil.
Yes, you know, it's most people would know albacore as canned tuna.
Exactly.
But actually, the fish is really delicate and quite beautiful itself if you just put a very light sear on it and serve it rare. It's a wonderful texture and a really nice flavor. And then, of course, we're complementing it with some vegetables from the season.
Do you have people, foragers, knocking on your door with bags of mushrooms and things?
We do all the time. In fact, today we picked up 4 pounds of candy cat mushrooms that came out of the hills to on Sunday, I guess.
You must know your mushrooms. How do you know whether it's safe to take
them?
Yeah,
we do.
We forage ourselves.
We do forage ourselves. Oh, okay. We like mushrooms a lot, and we've worked with a lot of them. But people come and knock on our doors to offer us what other people don't want, you know, which is like kind of weird stuff that not everybody uses, but we love to experiment and try new things.
But you must be one of the more sophisticated restaurants in the area, no?
Yeah, I think there's plenty of other places that are doing really nice sit-down dinner, but I think the majority of it is more mainstream. It's more bistros or Italian or California French. It's more straightforward kind of stuff. I think we also do nice sit-down dinner, but we're a little bit more experimental in the flavors and combinations of flavors.
Yeah, it's very creative. What about the dessert program, Veronica?
Well, the dessert, since our menu has only 10 items, we have always one cheese course kind of thing, one chocolate-based dessert, and one fruit-based dessert. So we can give a little for everybody. Sometimes people want to start with cheese, or sometimes they want to finish with it. So we always use like seasonal things like Chris is saying, and just different techniques that complement the main ingredient. We always use some kind of dark chocolate between 96 and 97% dark, so it's very bitter. And then use a lot of herbs and spices and sometimes vegetables in our desserts. I'm not a sweet dessert pastry chef. Sugar is not my main component at all. You know, I love to use honey and agave and sometimes just the fruit itself that will sweeten up the whole dish. So it changes constantly. We have a couple items that stay the whole season just because people like them so much and we keep them. But on the other hand, we change a lot the other ones so we don't bore our clients that come every week.
So tell me secretly, what was the biggest surprise you found You've been open a year now. What surprised you the most in your experience here?
How much work it is.
Oh,
you're coming to it, but I just think own it. We run it. We cook here. We do everything. We don't have a manager. We don't have a sous chef. We don't have a personal assistant or anything in between. So it's just a little overwhelming to be like in charge of every single thing. You know, we do payroll. Chris fixes the door that makes the noise. I cook. You know, it's a little of everything. If we have to clean, we clean. The whole thing is kind of a little surprisingly overwhelming.
I think for me the biggest surprise was since I'd always been a kitchen person, and now that we have an open kitchen here, is dealing with clientele. You know, I'd never been a waiter or never been a host or anything like that, so I had to really quickly learn how to turn it on in front of the guests.
Yeah, because some people, especially the people that sit at our tables that are right in front of the kitchen, it's for them, it's like watching TV.
Yeah.
So they're like constantly looking at you, and it's sometimes a little...
Well, they're used to watching
weird.
All the cooking shows on the Food Network.
I'm not used to people watching me how to do... You know, I'm not Rachel Ray or anything like that. So, you know, I cannot entertain what I'm doing. I'm very serious and very on top of my stuff, and kind of makes it a little more difficult for us to have a flow, because, of course, we have good nights, we have bad nights, and sometimes we get upset about things, and you always have to smile and talk back to the guests that come so happy, you know, to say thank you or whatever, and we're like going down on the other hand, so it's kind of a little difficult.
Well, how about giving our listeners your website?
Well, our website is eve-berkeley, which is eve-berkeley.com.
Okay. Yeah, don't forget the three E's in Berkeley.
Yeah, Berkeley has three E's. And they can find our updated menu constantly. We always put it up.
And in order to make sure that this couple survives all the work they have to do, we're opening dinner time only.
Dinner only, yes, Tuesday through Saturday from 5 till 9:30 is when we do our last seating.
Yeah.
So this is not a detour. This is a destination, listeners. We're glad we made the trip, and I'm sure you'll be glad you make the trip too when you come.
Kristen, yes, thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you so much for joining us on the menu once again, and we're looking forward to a wonderful evening.
Thank you, our pleasure.
Thank you.
And just in case you think that On the Menu went to every fine restaurant in San Francisco, bear with us, because I'm sure sometime in the next 12 months we're going to be back again, because there are several great places that we missed.
Now, when we say that this wraps up, we still have, first of all, we went to places where we couldn't interview, such as one of our all-time favorites, Charlie Fan at Slanted Door. Then there also we went to Citizen Cake and Elizabeth Faulkner, who we've interviewed before, as well. She was so busy during the holidays. I've never seen so much cake moving in my whole entire life.
And
didn't have a chance to interview her. And then we still have the Cotonia and the Quince interview, which we will be running shortly. So we didn't exhaust all of our, and there are plenty of other San Francisco restaurants on our audio archives.
But we hope we haven't exhausted you. We're sure that you've had a great time following in our footsteps, or thinking about doing so. So anyway, we'll see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.